Hello, friends. Greg Kokel here. The show is Stand to Reason. Welcome. Glad to have you on board. And I'm looking forward to talking with you later on. The number 855-243-9975. But last week, one of our callers took me to task about some things that are in the Old Testament. One of the more difficult things, challenging things, I think, for us as followers of Christ, insofar as we represent the Bible as the Word of God to people, is there are a lot of things in the Bible that are awkward, to put it simply. There are things that Jesus says that are hard to understand. There are things that we find in the law, the Mosaic law, that seem unusual to, at least at first reading, to 21st century moral sensibilities. There's always a difficulty when you have an ancient text, Old Testament, for example, that is 2 to 4,000 years old, actually more like 2,500 years to 4,000 years old, depending. And you are far removed in time, you are removed in language, you are removed in culture, and these all create a kind of distance that makes the text, what's recorded there, even seem weirder than it might be. And so when Alex called last week and raised the question about slavery in the Old Testament, which has come up before on the show, and we've talked about it, I answered some of the questions, but also find myself a bit out of my depth with regards to some of the detail that he was asking about. And in a situation like that, it's always good to confess your ignorance, which I did. Okay, I'm Alex. It's as far as I can go, but I need to get somebody who knows a lot more about this than I do, and I know of no one better to fill in the gaps of my knowledge on this particular issue, not only the issue of slavery in the Old Testament, but a whole bunch of other odd things than Paul Copan. He's author of Is God a Moral Monster? Making Sense of the Old Testament God. And Paul, what a treat to have you on board with me today.
Wonderful to be with you, Greg. Great to be on your program. I think it was my third time or so, but it's always a treat.
Yeah, and it's been a while, I think. So I just ran into this speed bump last week, and I thought I got to get Paul on, and I got to chat with him a little bit about this issue. So you heard my opening remarks. We aren't going to do a full hour on this. We've already talked, I think, about your book, Is God a Moral Monster, which has been out for quite a while, and I always recommend it to people to read regarding a host of issues, and slavery being one of them. And I think the problem is, and maybe we'll just start out like this, the problem is when people see the word slavery in the Old Testament, a certain image comes to mind that I think itself creates some problems. And that image is, of course, the American slave trade system, or the slave trade system of the West during that time. And this is what people envision is being endorsed by those texts where they find the word slavery in translation of the Hebrew words to describe things that were going on in the in Israel and God's regulation of that. Why don't you, just by way of introduction to this topic, though, tell us just a little bit about that comparison between, you know, the image people have of slavery in America and the kind of thing that is actually going on in the Old Testament.
Right. Yeah. Well, it is good to make that comparison because there is a lot of emotion involved in the term slavery, and unfortunately, many of our modern-day translations, despite colonialism, despite the Civil War, despite Jim Crow laws and everything, it's interesting that, you know, the King James Version, 1611, only had the term slave once mentioned, and it actually isn't even in the Hebrew text. It's just added by the editor or the translator. But with all of that baggage, you now have scores of mentions of the term slave, say in the NIV and slavery, and again, it does create that kind of a reaction of that association, and I think something more like servant would be better. But really, it has to do with a dynamic dependency relationship, because the term itself is neutral. The term for servant or slave, sometimes translated eved, the Moses and Joshua are called the servant of the Lord, eved Adonai. That you have in the book of Exodus, you have in Egypt, you have the not only the people of Israel are called slaves of Pharaoh or servants of Pharaoh, you also have the people of Egypt themselves who are servants of Pharaoh. But God is bringing them out of one dependency relationship, and he says, "Let my people go that they may serve me," related to the word servant, that they may serve me in the wilderness. So they're moving from one dependency relationship to another. One is negative, one is very positive. They're liberated and so forth. And I'd like to mention, too, that if certain mandates or commands in the law of Moses were attended to, then the sorts of things that we associate with the antebellum South, the pre-Civil War South, just would not have been an issue. For example, you have ways of easing poverty, and if you were impoverished, that was really what led you to becoming a servant of someone else. Mm-hmm. And so Israel had provision for those gleaning laws and so forth, that you were to look out for those who are the most vulnerable in society, the orphan, the alien, the widow who are in your midst. Also, if you injured your slave, gouged out his eye, knocked out his tooth, the servant could go free, and without having to pay any further on his indentured servitude. And there's a cap on that for the Israelites. Mm-hmm. Also, there's no right of return. Runaway foreign slaves from surrounding nations, we read in Deuteronomy 23 that they could settle in any of Israel's cities, that they were free to settle in there rather than being returned to their harsh masters. The Babylonian Code of Hammurabi mandated that under penalty of death you were to return a slave to his master. Mm-hmm. You also have capital offense of kidnapping, that kidnapping was not allowed. And so, and again, that's how the modern slave trade got started. So if those sorts of things were attended to, then it would be a lot different an issue.
Yeah, I agree with that. Two thoughts here quickly. One is, I heard Peter J. Williams, a Cambridge biblical scholar, talk about this issue, and he made the observation, as something you mentioned earlier, that up until the turn of the 20th century, so up until the late 1800s, there was virtually the word slave in the translations didn't occur. It was almost always translated as servant, the word ebed. But after the beginning of the 20th century, you could actually chart how there was a trend that changed, and this word ebed was more consistently translated slave, until nowadays it's all over the place, creating an entirely different impression than what used to be regarding what was going on in Israel then. So what's going on with that?
Yeah, I mean, it is a puzzling thing, especially given the emotion that is bound up with the term slavery and the associations that come to people's minds. So I think that sort of a thing was not properly attended to by the translators.
Yeah.
As I said, it is a neutral term, and depending upon the context, like slavery in Egypt. That is oppressive. Servitude with God in the wilderness, that was a different story.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the sorts of things. The same term is being used.
Yeah, well, to be fair to Alex, he did raise this point, because I had offered some of the thoughts based on my reading of your material and some others, that there is this distinction here between a slave in the sense that we think of this forced servitude where there is all this human abuse and chattel property, essentially, and the kinds of indentured servanthood that was characterized by the Mosaic Law. In fact, the way I used to sum it up, Paul, is I said, well, those in Israel that were under these circumstances actually had union representation, and they had a contract, and it was called the Mosaic Covenant. You know, the law put these kinds of protections and constraints in place, and Moses was their advocate. So, however, what Alex said is it doesn't matter whether you call it a servant or a slave. If the circumstances that are described are that human beings are property that could be owned and then used or abused at will and then passed on to your offspring or whatever, you know, as part of, in your will, it doesn't matter. You want to call them servants, fine, but it's the same kind of thing. So this is why I thought it would be really good to be able to talk in a little bit more detail with you about this. You've already outlined some of the differences between the servanthood / slavery, however you want to characterize, ebed, the Hebrew word translated there in the Old Testament, and the other European, or rather the ancient Near Eastern nations. What about this whole idea of owning the human being and the concept of chattel or property? It does seem when you read some of the texts that that's what's being characterized in the Mosaic Law.
Right. Well, I think that the text that Alex was referring to was Leviticus 25, and I'd say that this is probably the most challenging text, but I think when you understand what's going on, both in the broader context and even within the more specific text itself of Leviticus 25, a lot of the issues are fairly well resolved. For example, you know, in Leviticus 25, you know, in verses 42 to 46, it refers to being able to acquire, the verb kana, being able to acquire male and female servants, slaves, from pagan nations. It says that out of the sons of the sojourners, the word toshavim there, who live as aliens, gerim, keep that in mind, toshavim, sojourners, gerim, aliens, that they may also become, and here's the term, your possession. You may even bequeath them to your sons after you to receive as a possession. You can use them as permanent slaves, servants. And so people say, wow, they're just being treated as property, aren't they? Mm-hmm. Well, a few things to keep in mind. One is that the Israelites are called to have compassion on those who are sojourners and aliens there. That in Leviticus 19, God reminds the Israelites that they too had been strangers, gerim, aliens, in the land of Egypt, and that this was to inform them as to how they were to treat foreigners in their midst.
Right.
So throughout, you know, Leviticus, Deuteronomy, you see the importance of loving the stranger. You shall love the stranger in the land and the native. We read. We also see furthermore that in this in this context, we already saw that Israel was to protect oppressed runaway slaves.
Mm-hmm.
So if this is supposed to be a land of refuge for runaway slaves, as we read about in Deuteronomy 23, it's not as though we're switching gears here to allow for oppression. We see that there is the importance of the love of the stranger.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Israel's laws were to protect all people, that all of Israel's laws were to protect both the Israelite servants as well as strangers, as Exodus 21 and Deuteronomy 23 remind us.
And that was unusual for ancient Near Eastern laws, right, in terms
exactly.
of equal.
Exactly. They had a more of a classist system, a more of a hierarchy than what you see in Israel, which is much more a democratized system.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when it comes to the term acquire, you may acquire them. Some people think, oh, this is obviously property. Well, not necessarily. I mean, we talk about teams having owners who sell players or employers who transfer employees.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean that they are somehow impersonal objects or something like that. Boaz acquired, same verb, kana, Ruth, as a wife in a legal transaction, and it has that sense of legality to it. There is, in the covenant language, the Lord acquired Cana, the Israelites themselves. They had been purchased by God who delivered them from Egypt, Exodus 15:16. So it's a term of the denoting the legal act of acquisition.
Mm-hmm.
Also, it's interesting that this is not commanded. It says, you are permitted to, rather than you must take servants or slaves. And how do you take them? Well, a lot of times there's war captives and so forth. There may be varying circumstances. It's not as though there's kidnapping involved or something like that. There may be a number of legitimate ways in which people acquire servants to work for them.
Mm-hmm.
Notice, too, that as you read in Leviticus 25, there's an interesting pairing of those verbs, that those words that I mentioned, the stranger, as well as the sojourner, the ger and the toshav,
mm-hmm.
Where you have, all they're supposed to be able to rest on the Sabbath, verse 6 of Leviticus 25,
uh-huh.
That the Israelites themselves are called sojourners and aliens, verse 23. The poor Israelites are considered to be like aliens. It says Israel is to sustain, verse 35, Israel is to sustain a poor countryman like a stranger or a sojourner,
mm-hmm.
that he may live with you. In other words, there is a priority given to the strangers and aliens to look out for them. Also, a verse that is often neglected is people just stop reading at verse 46. It goes on to say in verse 47 that it was possible that the means of a stranger or of a sojourner with you can become sufficient to the point that this person can actually take on an Israelite servant for himself. In other words, these people who are, sojourners, working for you, they can actually become persons of means and actually acquire an Israelite for sort of the same word, that is used there. It can be someone who is redeemed. Of course, it's not an ideal situation, God says in Leviticus 25. So if you can redeem him or buy him back, the term kana is used of the Israelites. So we're not talking about chattel. The Israelites aren't chattel, are they?
Right.
No, of course not. But so, again, as you look at those verbs, you start to see, they're not talking about chattel. You're talking about some sort of a legal act of acquisition.
Is that why...
another thing... Go ahead.
I was going to say, is that why... there is a provision in inheritance, because whatever financial interest that a person has in a servant that they have contracted with, so to speak, that interest passes on to the children of that slave, I don't want to say slave owner, because that may be
the employer.
Yeah, is that why that inheritance feature is in there?
Well, I think what we need to keep in mind too is one, the language here is very similar to what you see going on in Exodus 21, where an Israelite or a Hebrew, he decides that he loves his master, employer, and he is going to be with him permanently, olam. Same word that's used here. And again, it's through this individual choice of the Israelite to be with him permanently, and again, probably extending to future generations if that is desired.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not as though, again, this is just chattel. The person says, I love my master, my employer. I want to be with him. I want to stay in his household. And it mm-hmm. actually gave a great deal of security for the person. As John Golden Gay, the Old Testament scholar at Fuller Seminary, says, to be a servant within a household was to actually be part of the household. And it actually could be a very good condition. Secondly, keep in mind, too, that those who were foreigners could not acquire land in Israel. This year of Jubilee in Leviticus 25 that's being talked about refers to the land reverting back to the Israelite owner,
mm-hmm.
because the foreigners could not own land, and so they were in a much more vulnerable position if they wanted to come and live in Israel. They would have to, in a sense, attach themselves to an Israelite household to get along, because they could not live in the land by virtue of ownership.
Sure.
So again, you even have the elevation of those who are foreign servants. For example, Caleb's descendant Shishan gave his Egyptian servant Yarha to his daughter in marriage, and they had a child, as mentioned in 1 Chronicles chapter 2.
Mm-hmm.
But again, this is not at all justifying mistreatment or treating servants some sort of a dehumanizing way. Now, some people will say, look, it does say that you should not deal with the Israelite harshly in this very text.
Mm-hmm.
And so some people think, therefore you can treat the foreigner harshly. No, that's not the point. In fact, earlier in the text, it says that you are to look out for each other as you would look out for an alien or a sojourner.
Oh, interesting.
So there's no dehumanization. The Israelite, is not to be dehumanized. The foreigner is not to be dehumanized.
Mm-hmm. So, well, this does go to one point that the caller made, and it seemed as he read a portion of the text that there is one set of rules for Hebrew servants of Hebrews, and there was a different set of rules for Gentile servants of Hebrews.
Yeah. Well, one of the main differences here is that the Israelites, and again, it's in the context of land ownership within mm-hmm. Israel, only the Israelites can have land ownership.
Right.
The Gentiles can't, and so therefore they are much more vulnerable. They can be more easily taken advantage of and so forth. But a lot of times the only way to get along was to attach yourself to an Israelite household, and then that sort of a thing could be extended into perpetuity. But it did not require that you had to be that, it had to be that way, because you could potentially become a person of means as an alien or a sojourner,
right,
and even to the point of having an Israelite working for you.
Servants, right. So tell us, talking to Paul Copan here, his book is God a Moral Monster, Making Sense of the Old Testament God. Lots of different things he deals with, but one of the things is the issue, a question of slavery. And tell us a little bit about the economics of indentured servants, because this seems to be the broader backdrop of so-called slavery. And I guess we have to say it that way now, because the older translations didn't use the word slavery the way the newer
right.
translations do. Tell us about indentured servanthood and the economics
right.
of it for the rank and file.
Right. Yeah, well, of course, a person who would become impoverished, say, within Israel, he would, as the head of the household, perhaps, reach this point of extreme poverty, would maybe have to lease his land, and therefore, could not work it himself because of his impoverished conditions. And even to the point of, and sometimes the language is used of, selling yourself or selling your daughter, your own family members.
Mm-hmm.
And what is meant here is that there is this contractual arrangement, with a 6-year limit that could be potentially extended, as Exodus 21 says, to a lifetime of servitude.
Right.
But this was a limited contract where you paid off a debt. And Deuteronomy 15 talks about how when you let go of your servants, you are to load them up with provision, that there is to be, that they have taken care of their debt, but you are, in addition to that, you are to load them up with provisions, and not to withhold, not to be stingy, not to harden your heart towards him, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like when people came over to the New World from Europe, and they could not pay for their passage, they signed on as indentured servants
right.
for 6 or 7 years, and then they got to the New World, they paid off their debt after working, and then they were free to go about as free citizens.
Mm-hmm.
So that was basically how it worked. You worked yourself out of debt. You were typically with family relatives. You were within your tribal or clan territory, and so you would be typically with relatives. And what would happen is you would be provided for in terms of food, clothing, shelter, work, and so forth. So it gave a sense of security and provision during this time of economic difficulty and
mm-hmm.
so forth. So that's a little bit of the backdrop as to what's going on here.
Now, what about the passage, Paul, where it talks about if a servant, an ebed, gets married while in the employ of his master and decides to move away, then the wife and the children stay with the master, something to that effect.
Right. Yeah, that's the early portion of Exodus 21, verses 2 through 6, where you have keep in mind the contract here. Keep in mind that there is a certain contractual obligation that you have to fulfill. And that if you even if you get married during that time, you still have obligations to fulfill. It's not as though you just kind of pick up and go. It's sort of like if you make a you sign a contract with the Army, mm-hmm. and then you get married thereafter, it doesn't mean that your obligation to the Army is no longer valid.
Right.
No, you finish that out. And so basically what's going on in Exodus 21 is that you basically, the person who got married while in this situation, had three options. And again, it could be either a male servant or a female servant. The Mosaic law isn't being gender specific here, although some people interpret it as such.
Uh-huh.
You could just as well say that it's the female who can go out because her contract has been fulfilled, whereas the male has to stay behind because his contract has not yet been fulfilled. But basically, if there is a marriage arrangement, if there are servants within the same household who are married and it's approved by the employer, then there's a certain obligation that is underway that needs to be fulfilled. So you could either, if let's just say it's the man who finishes his obligation
right.
early, he could either delay. In this situation, he could leave so that he can earn his own way, but yet without his family. So he could delay staying with his family.
Mm-hmm.
But that was often impractical. You really had nowhere to go. You're closely tied to your family and
right.
so forth, and it didn't make sense to try to kind of make on your own. Also, another option was to simply pay, to try to buy out your family from this contract, or to redeem them
mm-hmm.
While sustaining yourself. But this is often a very difficult, financially difficult situation
right.
to achieve. The more likely scenario was that you permanently would attach yourself to your live-in employer and to be with his family. That was the more likely scenario that
uh-huh.
would often work out, until, of course, you have the year of Jubilee, where you could kind of plan ahead, and if it would be the 50th year, that would be kind of a gauge by which you made
mm-hmm.
certain judgments and so forth. But again, that's generally how it worked, those three options.
Mm-hmm. Well, Paul, what really stands out for me as you're explaining in tremendous amount of detail and depth, you really have a good grasp of this, is that if slavery in the way the word is translated now in the Old Testament, Ebed, slavery is like the kind of slavery you had here, all of the things that you described would not have had to been mentioned. Everything that you said are like I mentioned earlier, the servants had union representation. They were these massive amount of details that were meant to protect and regulate the whole enterprise of the servant-master relationship, which I think by itself speaks volumes of the difference, not only between that kind of slavery and what happened in America, but also the slavery of the ancient Near Eastern nations that was contemporary with the Jews.
Right, exactly. In fact, the one... an author in the Anchor Bible Commentary, which is kind of a standard work in biblical studies, said that Hebrew has no vocabulary of slavery, only of servanthood. That there is a difference between, even with some of the laws that may be more restrictive and with regard to servanthood. I think you're right in pointing out that there is a certain, it's to control things, it's to regulate things, it's
mm-hmm.
not, it's to make sure that things that persons aren't going to be abused and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot, and again, it's in contrast to the other biblical or the other ancient Near Eastern cultures, where when you look at the creation stories and so forth, humans are sometimes the result of the gods spitting, and human beings come from that as sort of a disdainful afterthought, that human beings somehow come on the scene, rather as opposed to human beings being made in the image of God,
right.
human beings sharing in the rule of creation with God and so forth. That is a far different picture. And so even if we have some laws that we come across that are a little bit more perplexing, I think we need to keep this to distinguish between the biblical vision overall
right.
and some of these laws that are perhaps a bit more regulative and restrictive and so forth that may perhaps may cloud the picture a little bit.
Right.
But I think if you keep the overall vision in place and you understand that there is a fundamental equality between the servant and the one who is his employer, you see that there is this biblical vision that needs to be kept at the forefront. And I would also also add that, you know, even if a person who has a servant, and you know, if the employer strikes him so that he is killed, he is to be, that is to be avenged. He is to this, the master, the employer, is to be put to death. There is capital punishment that goes along with that. So it really shows the great regard for the servant, and that he is not to be taken advantage of.
Well, that's really helpful, Paul. Once again, folks, to get all of this detail and so much more, just grab a copy of Is God a Moral Monster? Making Sense of the Old Testament God. Paul Copan's the author. Paul, I look forward to seeing you sometime in the fall. Are you going to be at ATS EPS in November?
I will be there. Looking forward to it, as always, Greg.
Yeah, thanks so much. By the way, we had a chat with Abdu Murray a couple of months ago with his new book out, and I think during that conversation with Abdu, who's become a great friend over the years, I talked about the first time I met him, and I think you brokered that introduction at ETS many years ago.
I think that's right. Yeah, that sounds vaguely familiar. It's been a long time, but Abdu's a great guy.
Yeah, thank you, Paul, for taking some time here on your evening, I guess. Now, are you in Florida now?
Yes, Florida.
Yeah. Okay, so just thanks for taking some time to help us out on the show, and look forward to seeing you next time.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Greg. Keep up the good work.
Okay, buddy. Bye-bye now.
All right, bye.
Paul Copan, C-O-P-A-N, Is God a Moral Monster? Making Sense of the Old Testament God. And he's got lots of other books, too. He's just done a great job making a contribution to our field. All right, let's go ahead and take a break, and then we'll come back to your calls on Stand to Reason. Did you miss it? I mean, did you miss the article or the resource that I mentioned on today's show? Well, that's easy to do, but we've got the answer. Every Wednesday and Friday on our website, we post the links to the guests, articles, and resources that I talked about on the show. So if you're looking for something I mentioned on the show today, just go to sdr.org, click on the podcast link at the top of the page, and under the weekly audio link, you'll find every show posted to our website, which includes a list of the things I talked about, so you can find that book or article that you're looking for. Again, just go to sdr.org. Click on the podcasts link at the top of the page.
You can connect with STR on social media to keep up to date on all the latest, including articles, videos, events, and giveaways. You'll easily find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Interact with STR staff, post comments, get involved with other like-minded Christians, weigh in by responding to some of the issues of the day, and see what's going on behind the scenes. Social media is your gateway to all the latest from STR, including speaking events, new podcasts, resources, articles, and what's on our mind today. Follow STR online and find all our social media platforms when you visit str.org and click Connect at the bottom of the page.
All right, friends, Greg Kokel here. I want to give you a number that was a jaw-dropper for me when I heard it. That number is the number of people that pre-registered more than 2 months out for our Rethink in Southern California at Calvary Chapel. That number is 867. I mean, we're pushing 900 for pre-registration 2 months ahead. I mean, it's unbelievable. We are breathless here. Because of the great response to, in general, to Rethink. That's a student apologetics conference that's coming up, September 28th and 29th, there we go. Of course, the pre-registration bonus is behind us now, but you can still go to rethinkapologetics.com if you want to sign up. $45 only if you register before September 21st. Friday night, all day Saturday, unbelievable lineup of speakers. Our focus here is going to be, has God spoken? Rethink how you see the Bible. All right, and the speakers include not only the standard Stand to Reason lineup, but Frank Turek is going to be there, J. Warner Wallace is going to be there, Jason Jimenez will be there. It's going to be a fabulous time. So I encourage you to check it out and be part of that. Every year we get bigger and bigger. That Calvary Chapel is going to be just bursting at the seams. We almost filled every chair last year, but now we're just way ahead of the game. In the 2 months out, we've got almost 900 people. So we hope you can make it. It's a tremendous amount of fun. for young people. The target is junior high and high school kids, but we're not checking IDs, so lots of parents come and other folks. And of course, youth group leaders are there as well, so we'd like to see you there. Rethink. Apologetics.com and September 28th and 29th. All right, let's go to the phones in Texas. In Texas, Jessica, hi.
Hi, yes, hey.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be on the show.
Oh, good.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, we discovered Stand to Reason a couple of years ago, and we've kind of been trying to catch up on all the stuff that we missed before.
Yeah, people tell me that.
Yeah, we are so super appreciative for everything. We felt like, as kind of in the millennial kind of area, we didn't really have a lot of, you know, resources with people giving us those tough issues and how to kind of conquer those things. Uh-huh. So we really, really have been appreciative.
Thank you. I'm glad to hear that. So what's on your mind today,
Jessica? Sure. Well, my question was sort of a complicated question. My family has been kind of hit with some tough issues this year. My little boy, he's 10, just all of a sudden out of the blue without any kind of warning or family history or anything, he just started having seizures that got worse and worse, and it turns out he has a rare kind of brain tumor, and we've just had all sorts of stuff going on. Mm. And so my question is just kind of regarding the role of demons and things in that. We've had lots of people come up to us and just be kind of well-meaningly saying, you know, we'll be praying for those bad forces to leave your life, or, you know, we hope that those demon things that are tormenting you will go away. You know, people just praying those kinds of things, like to banish it from our home.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've really been struggling with trying to find scriptural basis for that. And, you know, are people just trying to rationalize things that seem irrational, or?
Yeah. This is a little bit hard to answer, partly because we do have scripture talking about demonic activity, okay? But it kind of speaks somewhat generally, all right? So you have examples of what might be called covert and overt, okay? Things that are kind of beneath the radar, behind the scenes, or things that are right there out looking at you. Now, Paul makes it really clear in Ephesians 6, and you're probably familiar with this passage. He says, our battle is not against flesh and blood. That is, flesh and blood is a biblical phrase that refers to humanity, human, you know.
Right.
Just our, you're fighting with people out there. You know, that's not where the real battle is. That's real, but something else is going on behind the scenes, is what Paul is saying. So this is the covert element, all right? And he says that our battle is against principalities, against spiritual powers that are in the heavenlies, in the heavenly places. And this is why he says, put on the full armor of God so that you can stand firm against the schemes of the devil. And here, verse 12 of Ephesians 6, for our struggle is not against flesh and blood, as I said, but against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of this darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the full armor of God. So there you've got a fairly clear statement that there is a spiritual realm in which operates forces of darkness and evil in such a way that they have an impact on us in the physical realm. Now, the antidote Paul gives in this passage is that we are properly protected with our spiritual armor, and then he identifies what it is. And the spiritual armor there, like, for example, the belt of truth and the helmet of righteousness and preparation of the gospel of peace and shield of faith and these kinds of things, these are all, in a certain sense, theological elements. I think what Paul is saying is if we are properly theologically equipped, then we will be able to stand firm against those schemes. Now, I've talked before, Jessica, about how I think that the chief means that the devil uses, not the only means, but the chief means the devil uses to create havoc in the world, including with Christians, is through through lies and deception. And in fact, the
right.
scripture says that the minds and the eyes of the unbelievers are blinded by these deceptive influences. And so when we are properly informed by the truth, then we are not going to be taken in by that. We can stand firm against those schemes. However, there is an overt element as well. I was just describing the covert, like the behind-the-scenes activities, which are very powerful, okay? But then there's an overt element, too. That is, things you can actually see. And when Jesus dealt with demon-possessed people, okay?
Right. They knew that they had that in their life.
Yes. Well, there was the manifestations, right? People were sick.
Right.
People had fits and seizures. People had, at one point, a dumb spirit, a deaf and dumb spirit, so that the spirit in the person managed to have a physical impact on their health. And so I don't want to draw too much from this, because I think sometimes people get, they find a demon under every bush kind of deal. And it's
right, and it kind of doesn't go completely together, because if you have that armor of God and you have Jesus protecting you, I kind of recoil from feeling like that there's this emptiness that can come in. You know, not that people are saying demon possession per se. They're just
right.
saying that we're kind of being bothered by, you know, different things that we've
sure.
done, like VBS and stuff at church. But I just don't feel like that's, you know, that feels kind of presumptuous to me to
well,
feel
this
like
is,
that.
Right. Let me just say this, though. I am somewhat sure. sympathetic to those kinds of assessments, though they're the kinds of things that we have to be a little careful of, because they are conclusions we draw by looking at patterns. All right.
Okay.
And mm-hmm. I'll just give you one personal example, somewhat personal. It stand to reason God has been prospering our work really well over the last 25 plus years now. We've seen fabulous things that God has done. However, even so, there have been tremendous challenges that people have had in their personal lives. We've had deaths. We've had people with cancer who didn't die. We've had people. Melinda fell off fell off the ladder in December. Here now, almost 8 months later, and she's still largely inert in a bed. I don't take these things lightly. I don't think, well, these things happen to non-Christians, and they happen in ordinary living in a fallen world. When you see clusters of things like that associated with a group of people who are making serious inroads into darkness in the world, I think that would be a fair thing to say about Stand to Reason, the way God is using us. At the same time, you find all of these things happening. I don't think it's outlandish to draw the conclusion that there is a spiritual element to some of these. The things going on in the spiritual realm, in the invisible world, having an impact in the visible world. So, you know, I wouldn't say, hey, there was a demon who pushed Melinda off the ladder. You know, I'm not going to say that kind of thing. But this is where it becomes difficult in assessing, how does this all work together? I don't know. But it does seem curious that when you're, and it's not just us, lots of people serving the Lord faithfully end up getting challenged in lots of ways that just seem suspicious. So what this then
yeah.
creates in us is kind of a sobriety about the world and the way all of these things work, that is a willingness to say, okay, we are, as your friends might have put it, under attack. We are being
right.
vulnerable. If you want a verse to think about, 1 Peter chapter 5 says, be on the alert. Be of sober mind. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. So, gosh, I don't think that's just complete metaphor. There is a devil, and he is bringing trouble to Christians. And like a lion, like a wild animal. How does that manifest itself? Well, 1 Peter is a book that is written largely to Christians suffering, and a lot of that suffering is persecution. So I think it's fair to conclude that part of the challenge, part of the devouring that the enemy is trying to do is to bring persecution and suffering on the Christian who is looking to serve God well. And the goal there is to discourage and to silence. But Paul says, resist him firm in your faith, knowing that the same testings or experiences of suffering are being experienced by your brethren in the world. Like, you're not the only one that's suffering. Christians, this is the lot for Christians. And it does have to do, in some measure, with the powers of darkness bringing the difficulties on you. I think that's a fair conclusion from that 1 Peter 5 passage. And it's not the only one. There are a number of other passages that make reference. Don't give the devil an opportunity. Don't let a root of bitterness spring up among you. You'll give the devil a foothold kind of thing. So there are different ways that the devil connives, schemes, in order to undercut the impact of the Christian. And I don't deny that one of those ways, and I don't know how this happens, how this works,
right.
But one of those ways could be through attack on us physically or lying. In fact, if you look at Job, the beginning of Job, there the devil does go to God, and he says, Job, your servant is faithful because things are going well. So let me remove your hand of protection. Let me mess with him a little bit. And what happens to Job? Well, when the devil starts messing with Job, then people die and Job gets sick, right? So there does seem to be a connection. Possibly.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, that wasn't exactly. It's hard for me because I've kind of been leaning on the notion that, well, they're just trying to rationalize, trying to give a sort of foundation to why these things are happening. But to me, you know, the left-brained approach is just kind of what's a fallen world anyway. But that is really interesting. I mean, we've had a ton of stuff just, you know, and of course that's kept us from doing different ministries and things that we were doing,
Sure. Obviously. Yeah, so I don't think it's outlandish to draw a connection there, to connect the dots. And I do think sometimes people go overboard. You know, the devil made me do it, you know, and all that. When it says in James chapter 1 that we fall into sin because of our own fleshly desires, we give in to things. And a lot of times, sickness, much of it, most of it probably, is a result of living in a fallen world. So
Right. That's
true. However, we do see these things in Scripture, like the demon-possessed people being physically oppressed as well. We do see this in Job. We see this warning in 1 Peter. And so I think in Ephesians 6, so there's enough there to, in a certain sense, give us pause and at least cause us to think, well, maybe something more is going on here than just the normal rank-and-file suffering that everybody
sure.
has to endure. And if you think maybe, then this is an opportunity to pray more aggressively in that direction. And my prayers are what Jesus said, principally. I don't go around rebuking and binding and loosing and all of that. I think that's misdirected.
Sure.
You know? Here's what Jesus
sure.
said. Jesus said, here's how you pray. Our Father who art in heaven, et cetera, deliver us from the evil. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from the evil, I think, is the literal translation. Some translate it the evil one. Others say deliver us from evil. But in any event, the devil's evil. And so Jesus instructs us to go to the Father and tell the Father to protect us from the evil in our lives, whether it's personified or not. And I think that's the appropriate thing to do. So your rough times that you're facing may require you to step up your prayers a little aggressively. And it does not guarantee that you're not going to get thrashed in the process, because the devil has teeth. That lion has teeth. He's roaring and he's got teeth, and he does draw blood. But we are
right.
to resist him firm in our faith.
Right. It's just kind of ironic too. You know, if this is a congenital problem, we've had people say, "Oh, well, it just popped up." But if it was a congenital problem, and then all these things happened at once, it would make sense that it was just kind of being jostled by negative forces.
Yeah, and again, it is hard. I think it's hard to make those judgments because it's hard to always connect those two. If somebody is directly and obviously demon-possessed and is deaf and dumb as a result, can't speak or can't hear as a result, and then the demon is cast out and then they regain those capabilities, well, then we know there is a direct connection there. But it's not always so clear. So this is why it's important for us to be sober, is what Peter says, and be aware and to be prayed up.
Right.
All right?
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Well, do you have any resources or books or anything you might direct me to?
You know, I don't, except for going back to those passages that I just mentioned. Ephesians 6, I think, is the best instruction. Chapter 6, verses 10 and to the end of the chapter. That's what I'd suggest. All right, Jessica?
Well, thank you so much for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Yes, you're so welcome. Got to run. I got another caller here I want to chat with a little bit before the end of our hours, and actually an old friend, Ian Jones, Orange County. Ian, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Greg. What a pleasure to be on board.
I haven't heard from you in a while, I don't think, have I?
And no, since I came to your old studios and got to watch you live when you were talking to a guy called Paul Copan about Is God a Moral Monster?
Oh, okay. Really? Well, that was a while back. Okay. Anyway, glad to have you on board. And we got about 8 minutes here. So let's just jump right in.
Yeah, let's dive in. So I'm having a real struggle with somebody who I met on a running course. We go long runs together. He's an atheist.
Uh-huh.
And he's come up with this construct to explain morality, which is our debate at the moment, called contractualism.
Right.
And basically, and it's incredibly difficult to read, but long story from what I can read about it, it's a moral theory that talks about us being rational agents, and we would agree to this if we were good, but we're not really good, but it's this ethereal concept out there, and by being ethereal and not explicit, it gets around the need to ground morality.
Yeah.
I'm scratching my head here and going, how do I even start?
I'm not entirely sure. Let me just probe a little bit or offer some thoughts here. It's interesting, whenever I get in a conversation about morality and the nature of morality, I mean, keep in mind, we are all aware that there's a moral project. I mean, something about morality is going on. We talk in moral terms all the time. We talk about good and bad and evil and, you know, all those things, the problem of evil, right and wrong. We talk about rights, and all of these things are all moral language. And so the question is, and this is the philosophical question, what is the nature of the moral project? What is going on there? Is this just emotions? That's called emotivism. So when we say something's bad, we're just saying what we feel about it. Yuck. Oh, murder. Yuck. We don't like that. You know, it's not our flavor. But kindness. Oh, yeah. Yum. You know, that's one way of cashing out what the moral project is all about. Okay. So on philosophy side, when they study morality, they are studying it academically, trying to figure out what is the right way to capture what we as human beings are doing when we go through our moral motions. Okay. Now, my conviction, our Christian conviction, of course, is that morality is objectively real, that there are some things that are actually good and some things are bad. They're not mind-dependent. It's not up to the individual. It's not just an emotion. We are not relativists. We're objectivists, okay? Now, that's a way of describing the nature of the moral contract, of the moral project. And, you know, but I'm happy to defend that take is a correct take. Here's the difficulty, though, for atheists. Once you make morals objective, that is a feature of the universe that are not mind-dependent, that is human mind-dependent, it's not just a matter of personal opinion, it's like there's a law above everybody, well, then there's got to be a lawmaker above the law, above everybody.
Yeah, Greg, I'll just stop you there because I totally agree with all of that, and I've made that his view under contractualism is the get out of jail card.
Yes,
which is we don't believe in objective morals; we believe in this contract that's there. It's not really objective, and so the philosophers say, well, we can chuck out the grounding question with objective morality.
Right. Well, if it turns, that's the type of relativism. That is, things are not, that's a moral non-realism. In other words, morality isn't a real feature of the universe. Morality is just a word we use to describe the assessments or judgments that we subjectively make, which assessments or judgments have no basis in reality. They have other than our mere feelings or our agreements. Like, for example, our social contract. And I think this is what your friend is getting at.
Okay.
And so there's no need to ground morality if you don't believe in morality. And see, some kind of contractualism, social contract, is a denial of objective morality, and it's an acknowledgement that what we call moral is merely what we agree is right or wrong as a group at this time. And if we want to change our mind as a group, next week we can do that, and then our morals change, okay? Now, so here's my like response to that. I do not believe that anybody actually believes that morals are relative in any sense.
Yep.
And so contractualism or social contract theory, whatever, Rousseau, Locke, those guys— that's just a relativistic accounting of morality. We know that some things are actually wrong, and they aren't wrong because we just decided to define it that way. This is why we rebel against people in other cultures who are acting in a way that are not right, whether it's ISIS or Nazis or, you know, whatever, right on down the line, you know, slavery. The appeal to end slavery has always been an appeal that is transcendent. Human beings are the kind of creatures that it's wrong for you to do that too. Well, social contract approach, you're not allowed to say that. Because, wait a minute, we not in our culture, not on our contract, we are allowed to do that. And then what is a person's appeal? To me, the giveaway, the tell here, I'm moving quickly, Ian, just because we're almost—
No, I'm good. I'm glad you moved, because I do have a follow-up that I need an answer on. So carry on, Pete.
But the to me, the tell, the indicator, the giveaway is the problem of evil. Everybody knows there's something wrong with the world, and that's why they complain about it. But there is no problem of evil if contractualism or social contract or relativism or Darwinism or any of those relativistic ways of explaining morality are actually true. Then morality's not out there, and evil's not out there in the world. All evil is an assessment that people make about things they like or don't like. That's it.
Yeah.
Now, if that's true, if that assessment is a true assessment, an accurate assessment of the moral project, well, then there is no problem of evil, right? But there is a problem of evil. Everybody knows it. There you go.
We've been going around that house for a while. So here's a follow-up question, and it relates to the STR ask you had that you released yesterday. Which is his pushback to me is, how do you then determine which of the laws that we have in the Bible are relevant for all time? I know you've been speaking
Ohio
versus California law.
That's a little bit more complicated, and it's actually off topic for the atheist, because we can still argue for moral objectivism even if we don't know how to parse out the particulars. Look, at any moral decision-making is difficult. Trying to find the right moral action in any circumstance is going to be difficult. Ian, you got to call back next week, all right? Because this is a great conversation. I'd like to say more about it. But that's the end of the show. Good talking to you again, though. Greg Kokel here. Stand to reason. Give him heaven this week, friends. Bye-bye now.